right, please be seated. The next case on the oral argument docket for the Southern panel is Williams v. State, cases 55805 and 55806. Mr. Cohn, you're ready to proceed.
Okay, please the court. My name is Philip Cohn with the Clark County Public Defender's Office. I represent the appellant, Nancy Williams. Justices, I'd ask to reserve 4 minutes, if I could, for rebuttal.
Okay.
This case brings to the court some really timely and critical issues. It deals with indigency, probationer's duty to pay, restitution and other fees, equal protection, and even to some degree, debtor's prison. And those are really important issues that we need to address. But before we do that, I don't think we can get there. Because the appellant believes that the court had no jurisdiction to hold her and put her in prison on February 9th of 2010. The defendant was placed on probation on February 9th of 2005 for a fixed period of 5 years. That probation should have ended on February 8th of 2010. We all know what a year is. A calendar year starts on January 1st and it ends at 11:59:59 on the 31st when that ball drops in Times Square. We know the year drop is over. And by this court setting it 5 years and a day out, I believe the court had no jurisdiction to do this. Now, the state has cited the case of Sherman versus Warden. And in that case, Judge Fondi had issued a warrant prior to the time that the probation expired and had probation filed a notice of intent to seek revocation, I believe the court would have retained jurisdiction and could have done it after February 8th of 2010. But in this case, the Department of Parole and Probation just simply sent to the court a notice that they were going to discharge this client. Somehow the court just simply set it for a status check on February 9th. No documentation was filed, no notice was filed, and I believe that by one day, this court did not have jurisdiction. So we really don't need to go any further.
How do we deal, though, with the NRSs that we have 178, 472, 176.3353 when computing the expiration of a sentence? That any period of time of the day of the act or the event from which the designated period of time begins to run shall not be included. What do we do with that? Is it applicable?
Well, because I believe that a person is put on probation on a date certain, like February 9th of 05, was on probation that day. If she would have gone out and gone gambling, or one of the things that she was prohibited from doing, she would have been violated that day. So I believe that the statute that says that probation cannot be longer than 5 years is specific, and I believe that it trumps whatever statutes the court has just mentioned. We also have another problem, and with all due respect to counsel, I'd ask the court to take judicial notice that I know that was not raised below, but ask the court to take judicial notice that in the very middle of this probationary period, on July 1st, 2007, AB 510 went into effect. It wasn't raised below. But the fact is, this client was entitled to credits. And maybe the court needs to send it back to have a determination as to how many credits she was required to get. But it was not raised. I know that the court can take judicial notice that AB 510 went into effect on that day. Getting past that issue in terms of probation and the duty to pay restitution and or fines, clearly we have to either find, the court has to find that the defendant or the appellant willfully did not pay or did not make a bona fide effort to pay. In this matter, Nancy Williams was convicted of three fraud felonies. She is required to advise all future employers that she had taken these felonies. She also was required to spend her first 6 months on probation in the Clark County Detention Center, 6 months flat time. And so now she gets out of jail 6 months later. She can't do the job that she's been trained to do, which is to be a bookkeeper. There's no one to hire a bookkeeper who's been convicted of embezzlement. And now she's told, make $66,000 in restitution. She signed the civil confession of judgment. And she's been punished by 6 months in the county jail. What job is she possibly going to get that is above minimum wage that could possibly get her to the point where she can pay $66,000 over the course of now 4.5 years because she spent her 6 months in CCDC? There is no allegation by the state, this has not been, that she willfully did not pay this, that she had some large amount of money and just simply refused to pay.
Counsel, you've talked in terms of the first part of the language of Bearden versus Georgia. The second part of that language, besides willful, it talks about fail to make sufficient bona fide efforts legally to acquire the resources to pay.
That's exactly right. What I try to set this up that we're not talking about someone with Mr. Mitchell's abilities or my abilities or anyone in this court who has not suffered three felony convictions and does not have some of the infirmities that our client has. So I am going to talk about her ability to make a good faith effort. There were four hearings in which this was brought up on February 9th of 2010, February 18th, March 2nd, and March 16th. We learned that over the course of time, in the 4.5 years that she was on probation, she worked at Burger King for a while, and then McDonald's, and that was the best job she had because that paid $5.95. But as her health deteriorated, she could no longer do that. She took jobs as a nanny, which paid about $400 a month, and then when she lost that job, she worked doing odd jobs for her family and was making about $200 a month. Justice says she didn't make $22,000 in those 5 years that she was on probation. She's expected to make $66,000 in restitution, and she probably didn't earn $22,000. And it wasn't because she didn't want to. She clearly is indigent and falls below the federal poverty guidelines. There's a limit to what she could do. Now, at that hearing on March 16th, there was discussion about her infirmities and her inability to find a decent job. Now, the way I read the transcript is the DA was very skeptical. He made some discussions about not being able to find the doctor, that maybe he had some trouble in Wisconsin. But even the DA admits that she's morbidly obese. She's about 5'2" and over 300 pounds, more like 325. She has diabetes, she has hypertension, and she has chronic pain. The appellant put in a letter from Dr. Flowers explaining that she was disabled, and so along with those other issues that she had, Dr. Flowers reports that she has arthritis, carpal tunnel syndrome, asthma, hypertension, and angina, not inconsistent with her weight problems. The fact is, where is she going to find a job that's going to make any kind of reasonable dent in that $66,000? So the question is, how do we determine whether she made a good faith effort to pay the money back? She's never going to make $66,000, much less we have enough money to live and then give the state $66,000. So how do we determine what is a bona fide effort under Bearden or a good faith approach? And I believe that in the hearing that the court can find on page 66 of the appendix for the appellant, and it's from case, there's two appendix. This one's from 55, in case number 55806. On pages 66 and page 67, twice the lower court judge said to Ms. Williams, and also to the probation officer, why couldn't you make $20 a month? Why couldn't you bring a $20 bill every month? Why couldn't you have done that? And I believe by the court setting forth that $20 suggestion, I believe that the court set forth what is a reasonable amount of money. Well, I know from reading the record that the appellant paid $1,240. And when you multiply 60 months times 20, you get $1,200. So the fact is, since she spent the first 6 months in jail, and she paid $1,240, she actually did exactly what the court asked. Now, one other matter that I want the court to realize, it's not specified clearly, but I'm not going outside the record because there's a discussion between Mr. Hillman on the 16th of March, and it's at page 94-95 of the appellant's appendix, where it is mentioned that the appellant paid all of her probation fees. And that's why she was getting the discharge, because she had paid all the fees. She even asked the officer, wait, can't some of this money go towards the victim? Because I know the judge wants me to do that. And the probation officer explained, no, that's not the way the law works. I don't know if it's right or not, but that's not the way the law works. The fact is she paid $1,830 in probation. So she paid well more than that $20 that the court asked. We believe that the appellant made the good faith effort considering her situation in life. I'll save the rest of my time. Thank you, Justice.
Okay, Mr. Cohn.
Scott Mitchell on behalf of the Clark County District Attorney's Office in the state of Nevada. Your Honor, what's really important here is to understand all the facts, not just the ones that counsel has referred to. And this is important because the law interconnects with the facts in a very important way here, and that is that this court is being asked to declare that the lower court judge abused her discretion when she revoked the defendant's probation. And in order to find an abuse of discretion, the law says in Crawford v. State that the court has to find that the trial judge's decision was beyond reason or law or arbitrary and capricious.
As a starting point, Mr. Cohen has asserted that the court no longer retained jurisdiction to even deal with that issue. So, as a fundamental issue, do we even get into that?
I'll address that right now and then go back to my argument. Your Honor, there are several reasons why the court should find that jurisdiction was retained by the lower court. First of all, if you look at the appendix that was designated by the defense here, by Ms. Williams' counsel, you see that the report that the Department of Parole and Probation prepared for the trial court judge said that the probation expired on February 10th, 2010. So the judge was entitled to rely on that. Another thing that's really important about that is that the judge who revoked Ms. Williams' probation was not the judge who had sentenced her. Judge Wall sentenced her, and then in the intervening 5 years, it was a different judge who was assigned to the case to handle the revocation. So Judge Leavitt, the judge that sentenced her, did not have the history with the case and justifiably relied on the declaration by the Division of Parole and Probation that February 10th was the operative date for expiration of probation.
But does that error vest the jurisdictional issue? Is that error?
Well, Judge, I was about to say that it would be an anomalous result indeed if we were to say that somebody could escape sentence of imprisonment just because PNP, who's not composed of lawyers, had made a miscalculation as to when probation expires. This is something that Judge Leavitt could not be reasonably responsible for determining, because she hadn't had the case from the beginning. And so maybe if she had been the sentencing judge, she would have marked her calendar for 5 years hence and made sure that it didn't fall on one day too late. But I would also argue that we have to take into account judges have different schedules. They don't all hear criminal calendars on the same day. And Judge Leavitt doesn't hear a criminal calendar on February 8th, and she does on February 9th, and thinking that that was one day before the probation expired for PNP's representation, that's the day it was calendared for.
Well, it might be perfectly reasonable for Judge Leavitt, the state for that matter, to have assumed that the hearing could proceed on the 9th. But under your theory, or your argument, what would preclude the Division of Parole and Probation from requesting or giving the same notice that they gave a year later, saying, we're about to enter a discharge for this defendant, and the time period runs out on February the 9th, and they miss it by a year. Does the district court judge have jurisdiction in that case?
Clearly not, Judge. However, if the court were going to make a determination based on whether or not the error in retaining jurisdiction was due to PNP, I think this case ought to be remanded to have PNP determine how they calculated that date to be February 10th. They're only one day off, if they're off at all. But there is case law that we cite in our brief, which explains prior Nevada Supreme Court holdings that actually say that you can't retain jurisdiction over a probationer beyond 5 years. And so, in your example, you're extending it another year. That would be 6 years. That would clearly violate the intent of this court and Nevada law.
Well, do you agree that parole and probation miscalculated the February 10th date? Do you think it should have been February 9th?
I do not agree
or
with 8th? That.
Okay, tell me why under the statutes you come to that conclusion.
Well, February 9th was the day that she was sentenced. And I do not, frankly, know how PNP calculates how they calculate the expiration of probation, but I am not willing to say that they made a mistake, because I'm not schooled in how they do that. I think that
do you rely on any statute or case that would justify a February 10th expiration date?
No, Judge. I am only saying that the judge should not be held to a PNP calculation. The lower court judge should not be held to that. She had the reasonable right to rely on what they had said was the date. And this is an odd set of facts, because normally you've got the trial court doing the revocation, same one that did the sentencing. But here, she's received a new case. She's got a different schedule. And if somebody is able to escape a couple of years of prison because PNP is one day off, I just think that would thwart the purpose of the law. And that's an equitable argument, but
there would be competing equities on behalf of the prisoner in that instance, who had mindfully honored the terms of her probation all the way through, to her thinking, and had expired that period.
Well, Your Honor, if we're going to talk about the equities, I was going to come to this point. And the fact is that on the day that she was sentenced, and on a later day, which was her first probation revocation, she was actually told that before her probation expired, she would be asked whether she had paid restitution in full. And she would be held to account on whether or not she had made a good faith effort. She was actually told that. She said she understood. So she
was on notice that she would be expected to make an called to account for that.
That's right. And she didn't at any time claim that she had been financially unable to. She just showed up on the day that was given her, prepared to answer to the requirements that had been given to her 5 years earlier and then 2 years after that. So she was on notice, and she apparently believed that her probation hadn't expired and that she was going to have to account for what she had done with her chance to make restitution. And so she can't be heard to say that this was unfair because something was sprung on her. She knew very well, and say she said she knew. And she already knew that the Division of Parole and Probation was asking for a dishonorable discharge. She had knowledge of that as well, well before this February 9th date. Now, at this point, I think because of the way facts and law interlock, I think we go back to that original sentencing date and look at what she was told. Not only was she told that she would have this hearing on restitution before her probation expired, but she was also heard to beg for probation and say that her counsel said anyway that it would thwart the purpose of her paying restitution if she were sent to jail. So the court accommodated her request by giving her probation in the first place so she would have the opportunity that she begged for, which was to pay back the victims. Another thing that's very important about that is that she claimed at that time that she had already saved up over $1,000 for the purpose of paying restitution. So when we look at how much she paid over the 5 years, it's really $200 she paid over 5 years, not $1,200, because she had already, according to her, saved up $1,000 for restitution purposes.
Counsel, does due process require specific notice for an opportunity to be heard? You're giving us a general notice. She was told she'd be called to say whether or not she made effort. Is she required to be given a specific notice of when that's going to take place?
Your Honor, yes, I would say so. And in fact, PNP gave her that because they notified her before she got to that hearing on February 9, 2010, that they were going to be asking for a dishonorable discharge. And she showed up in response to that, and she was prepared to address the court on what efforts she had made to pay restitution. So she obviously had it because she appeared after being notified by PNP that that would be the day.
But I think Justice Douglas's question goes to incarceration, not dishonorable discharge. I think Justice Douglas's question goes to notice of the prospect of incarceration rather than dishonorable discharge as the consequence. And that's the due process question. Was she adequately noticed that the judge would incarcerate her on the 10th?
Yes. She was specifically told that by the sentencing judge, Judge Wall, on the day that she was sentenced, that she would go to prison if she didn't make a good faith effort. And he used those words, good faith. She would go to prison if she didn't make a good faith effort to pay restitution. Judge Leavitt, 2 years later, told her that as well. And one important point there, it was never required of her that she pay full restitution. In fact, the sentencing judge told her that he anticipated she would not be able to pay full restitution because it was such a huge amount.
But I'd like to return to my original question. For due process purposes, is it necessary for the notice from the Division of Parole and Probation leading up to the hearing about revocation or dishonorable discharge that she be told then that the request will be or incarceration, or do the prior comments of the judges satisfy due process?
Clearly, the prior comments of the judge satisfy due process, Your Honor. In fact, when she signs the guilty plea agreement prior to being sentenced, she is told in the guilty plea agreement, it's in writing, that she can go to prison if she doesn't pay the restitution amount, that these are conditions of probation to keep her out of prison. So she's been informed in writing, she's been informed specifically orally by the judge, and in fact here, PNP would not be expected to tell her that she could go to prison because they're not asking for that. We were trying to override PNP's request in asking she be sent to prison, but she had already been very well informed in writing and orally that that was in the offing and that that was a possibility.
Well, the statutes delegate to PNP the responsibility for collecting restitution from a probationer. And there isn't much indication as to what steps they took or didn't take to pursue that. But the party charged with the executive branch responsibility for collecting restitution must have concluded they got all they could get and they sought dishonorable discharge because they never brought this up before this point.
Judge, excuse me, as a matter of practicality, PNP does not do that. They consider themselves the receptacle where restitution payments are made, but they do not actively go after the restitution. It's a hole in the system, admittedly. But the judge that sentences...
Well, we're going way outside the record here, but I would beg to differ with you. They got 10 employees over there. They got a budget of about, I don't know, $5 or $6 million. I could tell you a lot about that, but that's way outside the record, and we're both outside of it, so maybe we better come back to the record in fairness. Right. I think what is clear, though, is that there are statutes that impose the responsibility of collection of restitution on PNP, whether they have the staffing or the funding to do that effectively is a separate policy question. But in the context of Ms. Williams' case, and probably lots of others, I know when I was a district court judge, I'd see this time and time again where PNP would bring to your attention in the last few days of a probationer's probation that they hadn't paid $200,000 in restitution. And what this case really drives at, assuming that the court had jurisdiction, is what are the courts, district court's judges' options in those instances?
And the answer to that is that the judge should, at the time of sentencing, set a status check date. 1 year down the line, 2 years down the line, check on restitution so that this person is ordered to come into court and report because it's not coming from BNP. And I know that Judge Leavitt, who did the revocation in this case, does that now as a matter of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that is the only reasonable adjustment that can be made to the status quo to ensure that restitution is monitored.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, however, as I have already argued, Ms. Williams received ample notice and warning that this hearing would be held and she would have to answer.
Assuming the panel concluded that the court had jurisdiction to evaluate this, how do you address the discretion of the judge in the face of the information supplied in the transcript about the health conditions and obesity and other health matters affecting the defendant's ability to pay?
Thank you for that question. It's very important to note that Ms. Williams' own doctor admitted that she wasn't disabled from performing work. When the state looked into her claim, he recanted his earlier claim and said that she could do office jobs as long as she was given breaks and as long as her job involved sitting, that she could do that. Well, that was the kind of job she had had when she committed these crimes. She was a bookkeeper. So he was saying, well, if she does bookkeeper type work, she can work. The court also found that she had been employed during the time of her probation continually, and that she had applied for Social Security disability two years before the final probation revocation hearing. So even though she was working, she had made clear that she didn't want to be working because she had tried to be declared disabled. So the judge had those facts in front of her when she decided that the woman could be working and in fact had been working, and since she knew that she'd already tried to pay $20 for her husband's books while he was incarcerated, that she could be making that $20 a month payment if she tried. And in fact, she had even said herself at the time of sentencing that she had currently a bookkeeper's job. So the judge didn't have any evidence with which to conclude that she was unable to work. And the judge had made clear from the beginning that no full amount of restitution was even expected. It was just that good effort that was expected. And it was concluded properly, I think, that she hadn't even made that she had been trying to get out of it ever since the day that she begged for the opportunity to pay the victim back.
Okay, Mr. Mitchell, any other questions by the panel? Thank you very much for your comments and argument. Mr. Cohn?
Thank you, Your Honor. To answer a few of the things we just talked about, Mr. Mitchell mentioned that she did have a bookkeeping job when she was put on probation. She never saw herself going to jail for 6 months flat time, so she lost that job immediately. And when she got out, the best she could find was McDonald's. But going back to the court's question about the notice and what PMP did, when she talked to her probation officer in January of this year, that's when the probation officer filed the notice to terminate probation and discharge her. That's what she thought was going to happen when she came to court. That's exactly what he told her was going to happen. He said, you've done everything you can do, and he testified to that. He wasn't asking for revocation, and I find that very troubling. The court asked me about the Bearden case, and the state cited it in their brief, and I'd like to read one paragraph from Justice O'Connor. But if the probationer has made all reasonable efforts to pay the fine or restitution, and yet cannot do so through no fault of his own, it is fundamentally unfair to revoke probation automatically without considering whether adequate alternative methods of punishing the defendant are available. There were no other discussions about other types of alternatives. That's one of the problems with doing this at the very last minute. We, of course, maintain it was way beyond the last minute. But if this would have been brought in earlier in time, the way Mr. Mitchell brought up, we could have done that. We could look, if you've only made a couple $1,000, between restitution and between probation fees, you've only paid $3,000. So let's find a different alternative. And I think we've all failed in the system. There are no restitution centers. There are no other means to punish someone other than putting someone in prison. This woman has done 6 months in jail at the beginning of her probation. She's done she's been in jail now for 7 months. She's done 13 months in custody for this case. She's tried to make restitution. She does have these medical problems. How severe they are, when you're, that it's open to some question. But any time that the government wanted to have an independent medical exam, we would have agreed to it. You just cannot get significant money from a person like Nancy Williams. Judge Wall recognized that when he sentenced her. And probation recognized that when they asked the court to terminate probation with a dishonorable. And in my mind, the court overstepped its duties, not just abusing its discretion, but doing what due process requires under Bearden, is what other alternatives do we have? If we would have brought her in early, we could have considered some type of office work that she could have worked in, maybe a state agency or somewhere where she had no access to money, but she was not going to get that kind of job on her own. She tried and tried and tried. Three felonies, embezzlement, she was not going to get that kind of job. She did everything she could, and I believe that justice demands that at this time Nancy Williams be released from custody. Does the court have any questions?
Apparently not, Mr. Cohn. Mr. Cohn, Mr. Mitchell, we thank you very much for your excellent advocacy today and your briefing on this matter.